Gemara tells or gives the advice, what should a person do if a person wants to know whether or not he will live throughout the year? Whether he will live throughout the year or not. The Gemara says, well, what he should do is light a candle in a room that doesn't have a crosswind, and if the candle burns to the bottom, then he knows that he will live throughout the year. Then the Gemara continues, that a person wants to know whether or not he should engage in a certain business deal or not. What should he do? He should buy a chicken, feed the chicken. If the chicken gets fatter, that is a siman, that is a sign that he will be successful in his business deal and he should pursue it. And then the Gemara continues, what should a person do if he wants to know whether or not he should take a certain trip, a certain venture? So the Gemara says what he should do is go into the house of his friend where it's dark. Presumably it's light outside. If he sees not only his shadow, but he sees a second shadow, why would he see a second shadow? Because if light is coming in from two different windows, he might see two shadows. So if he sees a second shadow, one lighter than the other, then he knows he should take the trip. What's the meaning of that? We get the candle for burnt to the bottom, but that's a siman that he'll live throughout the year. Kiner Hashem Nishmas Adam, the candle represents a human being. If the chicken gets fatter, it obviously represents a sign of prosperity, and that's why you should go through with the business deal. What is the second shadow? You know, how is that an indication that she goes through with the trips? Mefarshim explain that it's an indication that there's a malach who's got his back. There's someone there who's in the shadows, who's protecting him. Kim alach v'yitzav alach v'shmarach v'chol d'ratach, as the pasuk says. That's what the pasuk means in Parashat Shlach, when Kalev returns to the Jewish people after visiting Eretz Yisrael, and he informs them, kisar tzilom me'alehem, that it's safe, or you know, we will be successful in going to Eretz Yisrael and conquering the inhabitants of the land, because even though every nation has a guardian angel, if you will, that protects it, he saw already that Kadosh Baruch Hu had removed the guardian angel from the people who inhabited in Eretz Yisrael at the time of the Meraglim, and they knew that they would be vulnerable, they would be able to be attacked. So that second shadow behind them represents the Malach, who's there protecting him, and if he sees both shadows, he knows he should go on the trip. But then the Gemara says, Balav Milsahi, you know what? This is a bad idea. Because he might not see the second shadow, and then he might get nervous, and he will ruin his mazel. So better not to do that. The way the Torah understands the Gemara, and it's going to be important in a second, is that we only reject this last siman. Meaning, this second one with the shadows, that's a bit much. The candle is okay, the chicken is fine, the two shadows, whether you should go on the trip or not, let's leave that one out. The Beis Yosef, the Meiri interpret, this is a rejection of all of these kinds of, these simanim. We shouldn't do any of it. Not because they're not effective, but it sounds like that they're dangerous to engage in, because you never know what the results might be, and people might start getting nervous. Neither the candle, nor the chicken, or the two shadows, leave it all out. But not because they're not effective. So they're in meaning and indicating what will be what lies in a person's future. So therefore, the Gemara, in that context, couched in those terms, comments the following: Hashtada Marta Simanim Nosahi. Now that we have said that Simanim signs are effective predictors of what's to come, so then the Gemara quotes in the name of Abaye that it's a good idea, therefore, that at the beginning of the year, a person should accustom himself either to see the following items, or to eat the following items. That's a variation between the two texts that we have, either in Horios or Christos. In one place is to see them, the other place is to eat them. Again, that'll be significant in a minute. But you should either eat or see the following items, which are fenugreek, pumpkin, leek, beets, and dates, at the beginning of the year on Rosh Hashanah. Why these items, in particular? What's so special about these items? They produce quickly and prodigiously, so it represents being productive in the following year. So to see these items, the pumpkin, the fenugreek, the leeks, the beets, the dates, I'm not a farmer, I know how these items grow, I don't presume anyone here is either, but let's take the mefarshim at their word that these items produce quickly and in abundance, and therefore it represents that a person will have a year of abundance. That's the basic source of the matter. However, the Mefarshim asked two important questions. The first is that the two simanim that I mentioned by the Gemara don't really seem to match. They're not analogous. The first group of simanim that the Gemara mentioned, right, the candle that burns at the bottom is a sign the person will live throughout the year, the chicken that gets fatter is a sign that the business deal will be successful, and the second shadow that he sees is a sign that he should take the business trip, is predicting something that's already been decreed. I mean, it sounds like it's already been decreed whether the person will live throughout the year or not. But you don't know, light a candle to find out. Has there already been decreed whether or not the business deal will be successful? You don't know, so feed a chicken, and if it gets fatter, that's, you know, that it's obviously been decreed in your favor. The siman of Rosh Hashanah, you know, of seeing the pumpkin, the fenugreek, the leek, the beets, the dates, that is, you know, an attempt to change a person's fortunes for the future, not to reveal what's already been decreed, but it's an attempt to influence the future. These items produce, right, in abundance. If I want to produce in abundance as well, I want to be, you know, so successful, I want to be fruitful, then I should eat these items, which will hopefully trigger or open that kind of door for me too. But it's not revealing something that's already been decreed. It's an attempt to influence the future, which seem to be two entirely different things. The bigger problem, and the elephant in the room for this whole discussion, is this is not a very Jewish concept, right? The Pasuk tells us in Parashas Kedoshim, we shouldn't engage in superstition. Unfortunately, it's lamentable that the Jewish people have become overly superstitious. This is not our tradition, to be superstitious people to omens and signs. You know, this is not really what we do. This, in fact, is a prohibition of Lois and Achashu. The Gemara tells us in Masechta Sanhedrin means the following. If a person is eating a bagel, and he drops the bagel, and he says, "Oi, I dropped the bagel at lunch or breakfast. It must be, this is not my day." And he wraps it up and goes home. He says, "You know what, this is not going to be my day at the office, the market. I'm going home. I'm not investing anymore because I dropped the bagel." Or he's walking with a walking stick. The walking stick hits the crack in the sidewalk. "Oh, I stepped on the crack in the sidewalk. This is not going to be my day." Or a black cat walks in front of him, or he walks underneath a ladder. Or substitute, you know, any of the other sometimes superstitions that have made their way into our tradition. All of these kinds of things are lois and achashu. To kind of take this omen or this sign as an indication of something's already been decreed and this is not going to be my day or something like that. That is the prohibition of lois and achashu. So how are any of these simanim permitted? They seem to be kind of like omens of whether or not a person will work throughout the year, whether or not the business deal will be successful, you know, all these kinds of things. It doesn't seem to be a very Jewish concept. So in fact, it's for that very reason that the Beis Yosef, that the Meiri, rejected all of the Simanim of the Gemara. Again, the Tur accepted the first two, the candle and the chicken, but the Beis Yosef and the Meiri rejected them all, and they said, no, we can't accept any of that. That's exactly why the Gemara moved away from it. It's too superstitious for us. The Simanim of Rosh Hashanah are in fact different, as we already mentioned. Those are not revealing something that's already been decreed. It's not like I drop the bagel and say, "Oh, this is in Shamayim, this is not my day," and he wraps it up and goes home. That's Lois and Achashu. The Simanim of Rosh Hashanah are entirely different. What it's attempting to do is to change the future in the way of more an aspiration. In fact, more of a tefillah, more of a prayer. Not like the other Simanim of the Gemara, which the Gemara rejected. Not because they're not substantive, not because they're not effective, but because it's not a very Jewish thing to engage in these kinds of, you know, witchcraft and superstition. But the Simanim of Rosh Hashanah are entirely different, as we mentioned. It's confusing why the Gemara equated them in the first place, but now that, you know, we can perhaps distinguish between them, maybe the Simanim of Rosh Hashanah are really just a hopeful, you know, or attempting to persuade a Kadosh Baruch Hu to, you know, give us, you know, a similar outcome as we, you know, the fruits that we're eating. And in that sense, it's more of an aspiration. It's more of a prayer. It's more of a prayer. And therefore, the Meiri writes in his comments on Horios, this is really just to inspire us to do tshuva, maybe to change us, perhaps to change the world of Kadosh Baruch Hu in the form of a tefillah. Maybe tefillah is reflexive also, but it's in order to change us, to push us to tshuva, or maybe it's a tefillah towards the Kadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why the Beis Yosef quotes the name of the Mordechai, the Vudraham. It should really be couched in the form of a tefillah. That, you know, a person eats the krah, the gourd, he should say, "She karu, you know, gzar dinenu." When he's eating the gourd, even though the gourd is spelled krah with a kuf resh aleph, krah, which means tear up, is kuf resh ayin, so they're homonyms, they don't mean the same thing at all. But they sound similar, so one is a, you know, perhaps the launching pad for the tefillah of Shikare Zar Dinenu. As we're familiar with, many others, he might have been added. You eat the apple, and Sheshesh Shona Taiva Masuka, you have the pomegranate that we should, you know, Yibuskuya Sena Karima, and all of the different simanim that many people eat on Rosh Hashanah, we use them as a vehicle, really, for tefillah to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why it comes together with the Hirotzon. Hirotzon Ovenecha, some say with Hashem Elokeinu, some don't say with Hashem Elokeinu, or fine. Two opinions in the Paiskim, whether it should be with Shem or Malchus, but you say he runs some of an F, Hashem of the Kenibu, you know, Yirba Zakuya Seinu, Kriman. Really, it's really just a form of a tefillah, which is something we're quite familiar with, which is a very Jewish concept, and is deeply rooted in our tradition. So that's the way that it shakes out, according to the Iri, according to the Beis Yosef. That's the way it appears in Shulchan Aruch, is that this is supposed to be the form of a tefillah. This is very theologically sound. It makes us feel good. These are concepts we're familiar with. It does create a little bit of a halachic, technical conundrum. Why? Because as we mentioned, there's two versions of this statement that appears in the Gemara, one in Horios, one in Krisos, and there's a difference between them. In one place it says, a person should accustom himself to see these items on Rosh Hashanah. The gourd, you know, the pomegranate, the leeks, the beets, all the different items. You should accustom yourself to seeing them. The other place, the Gemara says, you should accustom yourself to eating them. Maybe we'll get to the heart of what that's about in a minute. But if one will presume, which I think is the minhag Yisrael, is to eat these simanim. By the way, this machlokes, whether you have to see them or eat them, is actually similar to another item on Rosh Hashanah, which is often conflated or confused with that of the simanim, but it's really entirely different. And that is the new fruit on the second night of Rosh Hashanah. That has nothing to do with the simanim at all. The Gemara says in Masechtas Beitza that in Chutz La'aretz, of course, we keep 2 days of Yom Tov. Why do we keep 2 days of Yom Tov? Yom Tov Sheni Shogalis, because they used to declare Rosh Chodesh in Yerushalayim. It would take time for that message to get to the outlying areas outside of Eretz Israel, and even by the 15th of the month, on Pesach, Sukkot, we weren't really sure what day was Rosh Chodesh. So because of that, in Chutz La'aretz, we have to keep 2 days of Yom Tov. Maybe in the Jewish month, it could only be 29 or 30 days. So there's really only two options, but we're not sure which it is. So we always have to keep 2 days. I'm not sure which day is Yom Tov. In Eretz Yisrael, they knew when Rosh Chodesh was declared in Yerushalayim, which day was Yom Tov, and therefore they didn't have to keep 2 days. Rosh Hashanah is an exception to that, of course. In Eretz Yisrael, also, they keep 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. And the Mishnah explains Rosh Hashanah that was establishment of the second day, but Rosh Hashanah was different than a typical Yom Tov Sheni Shogolis. Typical Yom Tov Sheni Shogolis, we weren't sure which day was Yom Tov. So one day is Yom Tov, one day is Chol, one day is a weekday, one day is Yom Tov, we're just not sure which is which. However, Rosh Hashanah, they were afraid that the shluchim might come, the messengers might come, seeing the new moon, very late in the day, and they would get confused as to which day is Rosh Hashanah, so therefore, because of the confusion that would arise, they just established, you know, carte blanche, that if the shluchim came late in the day, both days will be Rosh Hashanah. Either the 29th day of Elul or the 30th day of Elul, both will be Rosh Hashanah, because that and the first of Tishrei, Tishrei will both be Rosh Hashanah because it just got too confusing. So, because they might come too late in the day. So Rosh Hashanah was established somewhat differently than the other Yom Tov Sheni Shogolis. Other Yom Tov Sheni Shogolis, one day is Chol, one day is Yom Tov, we're just not sure which one. Here, Rosh Hashanah, because of the confusion of how late the people might come in the day after seeing the moon, they just established, you know what, everywhere we're just going to keep 2 days, but it was establishment to keep 2 days. 2 days, not because of any suffix, not because of any doubt, 2 days across the board. So because Yom Tov Sheni Rosh Hashanah is a little bit different, there's a big machlokes rishayim in whether or not we should make Shefianu on Yom Tov Sheni of Rosh Hashanah. Yom Tov Sheni, typically in Chutz La'aretz, Yom Tov Sheni Shogolis, Pesach, Sukkot, Shavuos, we make Shefianu both nights, no problem. Shefianu the first night of Pesach, so Shefianu the second night of Pesach. Second night of Rosh Hashanah, the Ga'anim felt Rosh Hashanah was one established, you know, takana, as Yuma Richtahi, it was one long day. Because even in Eretz Yisrael, where they declared the new moon itself, even in Yerushalayim, they established 2 days of Yom Tov across the board. So it was one day. So the Shaila is, should you have to say Shefianu on the second night of Rosh Hashanah? Some Rishonim held yes, some Rishonim held no. Machlokes. So it recommends the Shulchan Aruch, what should you do to avoid the machlokes? Buy a new item that you're wearing that either way warrants a Shefianu, or have a new fruit. In order to avoid the suffix, whether or not you have to make a Shefianu on the second night of Rosh Hashanah. Me'ikar Adin, if you don't have either one of these, you can make a Shefianu. We really pass, and you probably need a Shefianu on the second night of Rosh Hashanah, like second night Pesach, like second night Sukkot. But to avoid this whole machlokes, we have a new suit or a new other item, you know, clothes item, or a new food. We rarely make a Shefianu on new clothes today. Because new clothes, we buy clothes very often. In the olden times, they used to buy clothes rarely. Today, we buy disposable clothes and then we throw them out after wearing them 3 or 4 times because they're made, you know, in a very flimsy fashion. So we rarely make a Shefianu. Once in a long while you buy something that's very new and you rarely buy, you know, those items. A new shaito is a good example. You make a Shefianu, a new hat, the man wearing a shakhan, the talis, things you buy, shaito's like a beggar. So you buy these things, you know, rarely. Some women buy them more regularly, but personal. But so then you wouldn't make a shakhan. But if you buy them rarely, then you wouldn't make a shakhan. But since it's harder to come by a new clothing item that warrants a shakhan, that's really new, and you rarely buy these kinds of things, many people have a new fruit. However, it's a big machlokes whether or not you have to eat the fruit, or is it enough if you see the fruit? When do you make a shachiyano upon seeing a new fruit? Why do we make a shachiyano upon seeing a new fruit? We make a shachiyano upon seeing a new fruit because it's a new season of the year. Like strawberries are in season here, like if you ever kind of strawberry picking, like late April, May, June. So strawberries aren't a fruit anyway, to make it's a new vegetable, but May paraitama. But, you know, blueberries are in season around the same time. So that's when it's in season here. So am I making a bracha on the arrival of the new season? In which case, maybe I don't even have to eat the fruit. Because what am I thanking Hashem for? Thanking Hashem for helping me get to this milestone of seeing a new season of fruits, of living this long to be able to see it. And that's indeed the opinion of the Ramah, that you make a shachianu, you could make a shachianu even if you didn't eat the new fruit. You just saw the new fruit, blueberries. I said, thank you Hashem, shachianu, b'kiyumanu, b'kiyumanu, b'zman hazeh, you helped me get to a new season of blueberries. The other view is, or perhaps, a different way of understanding why we make a shachianu on a new fruit, is because I have new blueberries to enjoy. Until now, I haven't had any blueberries. Now, Baruch Hashem, I have blueberries. So then you make a shachianu on the blueberries, but you probably should eat the blueberries if that's the reason why you're making a shachianu. Because you haven't had them the whole winter, and now I have them again in late spring. So you make a shachianu upon enjoying the new season of blueberries. If that's the case, you probably have to eat the blueberry. Since it's machlokes to Shulchan Aruch and Rambam, when you have a new fruit, is it enough to see it, to make a shachianu, to trigger the shachianu, do you actually have to eat it? That's the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch. But Moshe actually claims, this is a suffix we have today, because you only make a shachianu on a fruit that's seasonal. If the fruit is not seasonal, in Hawaii, I bet Hawaii is like the same climate all year long. And they grow pineapples in Hawaii. One of their main farms in Hawaii. So I assume they grow all year long. So if the pineapple is available all year long in Hawaii, so then probably would never make a shachianu. It's available all year long. What about, though, Ramesh is a suffix, what about a fruit that is not available here all year long, naturally, but we import it from somewhere else? Let's say grapes. You can always find grapes in New York. How is that? Grapes don't grow here in the wintertime, I don't think. They grow here in the summertime. But in Chile, in the southern hemisphere, and in Argentina, in South America, they grow in our winter. So in the summertime, we have local grapes. In the wintertime, we have imported grapes. So can you make shachianu on grapes when the new season of grapes arises? So that's, comes around. That's what Moshe's suffering. But Moshe's not sure. And it depends on this issue. What are we making shachianu on? If I'm making shachianu on the arrival of a new season and thanking Hashem for allowing me to live so long to make it to a new season of grapes, well, then you can make shachianu on the arrival of the new season of Concord grapes, whatever it is they grow here in New York. So then you can make a shachianu on that, on the arrival of the new season of grapes. Well, Hashem, I made it to the new season of grapes of New York. It's a milestone. But if it's make shachianu on the enjoyment of a new season of grapes, we had grapes all winter long at every bodega on the street here. There are grapes available all the time. So then you wouldn't make a shachianu on the enjoyment of new fruit. You had that fruit all year long. You had that fruit all year long. So therefore, Ramesha says, Kemat, there's no fruit. You really warrant a shachianu today. Like star fruit, you could probably find the star fruit all year long. There's pickled pumpkin or whatever they have, pineapple that they have, or the kiwi or the sabra. All these fruits are available. No one's interested in eating them other than Rosh Hashanah, so that's when the stores order them. But I bet if you're a specialty store, you could probably find these. The star fruit is for sure available. I've seen it in the grocery. Now it's people are a little bit more exotically inclined. You can find these things all year long, all the time. So Rav Meisher argues, you really shouldn't probably make a shachianu ever on any new fruit. The only time you make a shachianu on a fruit is Rosh Hashanah. That's the only time. You shouldn't be making shachianu otherwise. And it's because we probably have to make a shachianu anyway. In order to kind of solve the dilemma of whether or not you should make a shachianu on the second night of Rosh Hashanah, if we have a new fruit. So, okay, we make a shakir on the new fruit. Go to the grocery store, buy something that someone made a special order for. But we typically don't make a shakir on the food, only do it on Rosh Hashanah. Do you have to eat it, or is it enough to see it? Big machlekes. Shulchan Aruch holds you have to eat it. The Ramah holds it's enough if you see it. One horror, practical, you know, just, I think it's obvious. And that is, even if, you certainly don't have to have a kazayas on the new fruit. Yeah, that's for sure true, right? But even if you have to eat it, who has to eat it? Whoever's making Kiddush and making the bracha of Shachianu and wants to avoid a bracha of Altela, that individual has to eat the new fruit. No one else at the table has to eat the horned pineapple, you know, if they're not interested in it. Because I'm not making a Shachianu. Whoever's making Kiddush is making a Shachianu. So that person has to make sure to have the new fruit. And again, you don't have to have a kazayas or anything like that. You probably should have to taste it. And even then, it might be enough just to see it. The rest of us could for sure be yaitzeh with just seeing it. Even the mavarit, even the person who's making the bracha might be able to be yaitzeh with just seeing it. Okay, but that's with regards to the new fruit. With regards to the simanim, similar machlekes. Do you have to, two girsos in the Gemara, two versions in the Gemara, do you have to see the simanim or do you have to, you know, eat the simanim? If you have to, presume for the moment, that we'll make a good argument why seeing is enough. But if you have to eat them, so now we have a problem. Why? Because the Beis Yosef and the Meiri told us it's a tefillah. That's the whole reason why we do these simanim. We're not superstitious people. We have chickens and candles and shadows. But this is rational. Makes sense. It's a form of a tefillah to our Kadosh Baruch Hu. Yiratzon lo fanecha, shemokeinu v'kei v'oseinu, she'yir v'zuchu yoseinu k'rimon. Or you have the raisin and celery. You have a raisin celery. Everyone makes all the simanim, and all these families have wonderful menhagim, and it's fantastic. It's a vehicle for tefillah to a Kaddish Baruch Hu. Fantastic. The problem is, when are you going to make your tefillah? Why? Make it right before you eat it. Not so fast. Why? Because generally, if a person is in the middle of a meal and a new food, right, potato kugel comes after you make hamotzi at the beginning of the meal, you don't have to make a bar for them on the potato kugel. Why? Because, you know, normal Shabbos meal has chumot and potato kugel. That's what I expect to come out. That's dvarim ha-boyim machmas ha-sudah. It comes as a part of the sudah. However, if you eat something that doesn't normally come as the part of a meal, you have to make a bracha. You have to make a bracha on it because it's not part of the meal. Some feel dessert is not part of the meal because it doesn't fill you up. People are full, presumably, from the other items of the meal, and now they're eating dessert. Others feel that dessert does fill you up, right? If the food is bad, so at least you have dessert, right? At least you have a chocolate cake or something. So dessert is always the fail-safe. So then maybe you wouldn't have to make a bracha on dessert, because that also sometimes fills me up. Or maybe dessert itself, right? People plan for dessert. There's some people so strategic about how they go about their meals. So if that's the case, so then you budgeted, you know, part of your stomach or your calorie count, you know, limits. You put that in, so then fine. So then the dessert is part of the meal. You wouldn't make a bracha. So over here, if you have an item that's not part of the meal, so like a salad is an appetizer. That's part of the meal. Main course obviously is part of the meal. What about these simanim? Simanim. Apple, pomegranate seed, you know, carrot or something. That's not, if it's not part of a salad, it's not part of the meal. We would have to make a new bracha. We'd have to make a new bracha. One cute way I've seen in the last 10 years or so, of avoiding this issue of making a bracha on all the simanim, is a hadama, by the way, in a carrot, random carrot at the beginning of a meal, not normal. You know, a random pomegranate seed at the beginning of a meal, also not too normal. Probably a random apple, probably need a bracha, bar priyadama. What some people have done, which is really is lumbish, is they make each one of the simanim into a course. That you have to have a lot of time. I'm not advocating for it. Not everyone has that much time. But, you know, leek muffins, pomegranate salad, you know, apple pie. I've never seen anyone put honey on apple pie, but, you know, you get the idea. But if you make it into something that's a course in the meal, then you don't need a bracha. But most people are not going to have time for that. They're going to buy the Seder plate of simanim for the beginning of the meal, and now we're going to have to make a bracha. You have to make a bracha, bar priyat on the apple, on the pomegranate seed, bar priyat adama on the, you know, the leek, or whatever. The fish, if you eat the fish head, that's probably the fish at the beginning of the meal. That's like a course. But the other items, you probably need to make a bracha. Ah, so now we have a problem. Because according to the Beis Yosef and the Meiri, you have to say a tefillah together with the simanim, and assuming for the moment that you have to eat the simanim, which means you're going to have to make a bracha, how do I negotiate? How do I juggle all of these different things? Why? Make a bracha, say, Bari Priya eats on the apple, Yiratzam of Vanech Hashem HaKadim HaKadim HaSeder, Shehidon HaShoda Toivu Mesuka, and eat your apple. It's a hefsik. So Magen Avraham brings two opinions. Is it a hefsik? Is it not a hefsik? It probably is a hefsik. In the middle of making Bari Priya eats, I'm going to say, stop for a moment, say Yiratzam, I should have a happy, sweet new year, and then I'm going to go and eat my apple. It's a hefsik. It's a hefsik. So what's the other option? What's the other option? Say the Yiratzam first. Then bracha, bari priya eats, then eat your apple. Can't do that either. Can't do that either. Rabbi quotes the name of the Eli Rabba. It's also a problem. Why runs afoul of a different principle? Zohar Kadosh tells us in Parshas Vayechi that whenever you want to thank an individual, or you have to thank the individual, and you have to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the same time, you always have to make sure to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu before the individual. Never thank the person before the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because the Gemara tells us in Masechtas Nedarim, commenting on the pasuk in Parashas Lech Lecha, that after Avraham Avinu was successful in the war with the four kings and the five kings, he successfully redeems or liberates Lot, and then he comes back with a lot of spoils of war. He meets Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem, and he gives him Vayiten Lo Maser Mikol. He gives him Maser from everything that he has. Why is he giving him Maser? Because Malki Tzedek was a Kohen. Who Kohen? The Kel Elyon. He was a Kohen. So Malki Tzedek blesses Avram Avinu. Baruch Avram LeKel Elyon, Kohen Shemayim Baretz. Blessed are you, Avram, the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who owns the entire world. And then Malki Tzedek thanks HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Baruch Kel Elyon, Hashem Yigein Tzarecha B'yadecha. So he thanks the Kodesh Baruch Hu. First he thanks Avram, then he thanks the Ribbono Shel Olam. So the Gemara says in Masechtas Nedarim, who is this Malki Tzedek? Who is Malki Tzedek? Malki Tzedek was Shem, the son of Noach. Shem, the son of Noach. And he was supposed to be the Kohanim. Wasn't supposed to be Shem HaLevi and Aaron HaKohen. It was supposed to be Shem, the son of Noach. But he lost it. That's why Avram Avinu gave him Miser. He gave him tithes. Tithes usually go to the Shem HaLevi. He gave it to Malki Tzedek. Because Malki Tzedek was supposed to be the Kohen. What happened? He blessed Avraham before blessing Hashem. He said, Baruch Avraham lekel elyon kanei shemayim baretz, before Baruch kel elyon, Hashem yigein tzarecha biyadecha, before blessing Hashem. If you bless a person before you bless Hashem, you can get punished, like shame, chas v'shalom, shame. Shame lost the kahuna, because he blessed a person before he blessed the Ribbono Shel Olam. I see people do this, unfortunately, all the time. It's, person in my life who does this all the time. He means to be very courteous. He's in general wonderful about me. So at the end of a meal, we'll always thank the hostess. Thank you so much. Now it's time to bench. Mamish, it's not in my place to tell him, but it seems to me that is exactly what the Gemara Masechtas Nedarim tells us not to do. A person brings something out to you, you can for sure say thank you. But at the end of the meal, you want to bless the person, or sometimes you see it as simcha. People thank the Baba, and they thank the Zayda, and the brothers, and the sister, and Acheron, Chaviv, thank you to the Ribbono Shel Olam. No, that's the wrong order. First, thank you, Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's what the Gemara says in the Dharam. And then you can thank the Baba, and the Zayda, and the brother, and the sister, and the mother, and the father. That's the proper order. So getting back over here, what are you going to do with your simanim? We have to make a tefillah, you have to make a bracha. Bracha, because it's dvarim that don't come as part of the suda. Tefillah, in order to avoid the problem of superstition. So what are you going to do? So he said, we'll make the rotzen. I want a good year. Thank you, Hashem, for the apple. Then eat the apple. You can't do that. Because what am I doing? I'm worrying about myself, blessing myself, wishing good upon myself. Then thank you, the Ribbono Shel Olam. Then I'm eating the apple. That's a problem. It's the wrong order. So the Paiskim recommends, so what should you do? What's the best etzah? What you have to do is, it's a little anticlimactic, I'll grant you. What you have to do is make a bracha, bari priya eats, eat the apple. Then, he writes him, ofanech Hashem alkeinu, b'pei v'seder, shilon hashon ha-tevu mesuka, eat the apple again. That's the way you should do it. I'm sorry, it doesn't seem maybe not traditional, but that's the only way to halachically negotiate the situation. First, you make the bracha, bari priya eats, Yehi Ratzon, then you eat it again. There's a similar issue that comes up when you drink L'chaim, for those who are so inclined. I'm not advocating for But for those who drink l'chaim, who drink alcohol, make l'chaim together. Why do we say l'chaim? Why do we say l'chaim? It's a very Jewish thing, right? Fiddler on the roof. Why do we say l'chaim? So there's two official reasons why we say l'chaim. One reason is because it's a machlekes in the Gemara. It says Tikkun Ezer. It's machlekes in the Gemara. What was the fruit that was part of the subject of the Eitz Hadas? What kind of tree was the Eitz Hadas? So one opinion of the Gemara is it was a chita. It was a wheat stalk. Not what we imagine. We imagine a tree with branches and leaves. One opinion of the Gemara was a chita. It was a wheat stalk. The other opinion of the Gemara is that it was a gefen haisa. It was a vineyard. Third opinion is that it was an eser tree. That's why we use it. Not surprising, we use an eserig on Sukkot, the first holiday, you know, after Rosh Hashanah. But the other two opinions are there was a wheat stalk and a grape. That's why, by the way, we make Kiddush Friday night on wine. We make Hamoitzi on bread. All an attempt to be Mechaper for the Eitz Hadas, which according to one view was wheat, bread, and grape, which is wine. So what happened the first time we had wine? First time we had alcohol? Didn't work out too well. Eitz Hadas, death. Arisha and Mechaper were kicked out of Gan Eden. So we say, L'chaim, this time not like this first time, right? That didn't work out too well. This time, we're drinking alcohol. We hope, you know, this time it should turn out a little bit better. There's another view that is because, other than the Farshim quote, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that a similar idea, when a person was going out for capital punishment, he was on death row. So how did they keep him sane? How was he able to sit there on death row and then march him out to be killed by Beis Din? So we got him drunk. Got him drunk. So who else was drinking? Not only other mechav at the time of the Eitz Hadas, which ended in death, the people on death row, we also give alcohol to. So we say, we might make a l'chaim, that, you know, this should not work out. Like, not like that guy, right, who's on death row, that didn't work out too well, that's l'mavis. So we say, this is l'chaim, that, you know, that's what we're drinking to. So that's why many come to say, that's why many have the midig to say l'chaim. When do you say l'chaim? Well, we have to drink. Before you drink, you say l'chaim. But the problem is you have to make a bracha. If it's wine, very free agafen. If it's some other, you know, liqueur or something else, shak on the evidvar, if you're of age, it's shak on the evidvar. So when do you make the bracha? So most people go, l'chaim, bracha to Hashem, shak on the evidvar, then they drink. The problem is, you just wish to yourself, chaim, then, oh God, you're here too, shak on the evidvar, and then you drink. You can't do that. You can't do that. So what would you do? Shak on the evidvar, l'chaim, drink. You can't do that either. That's a hefsek. So again, anticlimactic. What you probably do is make a shak on the abedvaro, drink, then l'chaim, then you can drink again. That's unfortunately the way it goes. But many chassidim know they had the minig to say l'chaim first, shak on the abedvaro, and then drink. How are you thanking yourself before the Ribbono Shel Olam? So they say upshot. Very nice. Yes, it's a beautiful idea. It says in the Magen Avraham, when a person walks into shul in the morning, a person comes to daven in the morning, they should think about other Jews. You should think about the mitzvah v'ahavta l'rayacha kamoicha. Even before you encounter HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the morning, before you say brachas, think how much you love other Jews. It says in the name of the Ari HaKadosh. Why should you do that? Because I don't want to approach Hashem alone. I approach Hashem alone, that's scary. I'd rather come as part of the team. Safety is in numbers. So we daven b'tzibor. You have a better chance for your tefillah to be answered. So I come, I think about other Jews. If I tie myself to other Jews, that enables my tefillah to be that much more successful. So perhaps, what I intend to do by l'chaim is I wish us all l'chaim, now let's approach HaKadosh Baruch Hu together as a team. And therefore, we can achieve something with the Ribbono Shel Olam. They say a beautiful remnant to this. Take it or leave it if you like this kind of stuff. But after the chet of the meraglim, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe Rabbeinu, "Vayom Hashem solachti kedvarach." Moshe Rabbeinu was pleading on behalf of the Jewish people for forgiveness. Hashem says, this features very heavily in the Tfilas of Yom Ha'Arayim, "Vayom Hashem solachti kedvarach." Vayom begins with a vav. Hashem, yud hey, vav and hey, begins with a yud. Solachti, samach. Kedvarach, chav. So vayom solachti, vav, samach, kedvarach, chav. If you rearrange them, it spells kos. Chav, vav, samach. Kos of schnapps, kos of wine. 1 minute, what about Hashem? Hashem, how is Hashem's name written in the Chumash? With two yuds. Two yuds could also be read two yidin, two Jews. When you have two Jews drinking a kais together, Vayomer Hashem Salachti Kidarecha. So they said we have to come together as a team. We come together to, you know, to gang up by the Rebbein Hashem Kriyavah, and therefore they say Rechaim first. If that's your minig and your family to say Rechaim, and Shachon Liyav Dvaro, then drink. Yeah, I wish you well. But for those of us, you know, following more what it says in the books, so then what you should really do is make a bracha, drink again, and then say your Yihiratzon, your Rechaim, if it schnapps, and then drink again. There's another technical thing which is important to keep in mind in the Simanim, which is similar to this. You know, like this is, you know, the AP Simanim. This is for the people who really know what they're doing. There's another really technical thing. If you really want to make sure you're doing everything, you're dotting your I's and crossing your T's, when it comes to Simanim, the post can raise, and that is that the first simon that people have is the apple. The problem is, and it says like that in the Ramah, the minig is to have an apple dipped in honey, the minig is also to dip the challah in the honey, but we don't say anything with the challah in the honey. Many people have that minig throughout Sukkos. The apple in the honey, we say, and you know, of course, you don't make a new bracha on the bread when you eat it as a simon, because that's the hamoiti lechem min haaretz you just made. And bread, that is the, obviously comes at the beginning. What about the apple? The problem is, apple's great, you make a bracha on an apple, we love apples. Problem is, you're about to bring out, if you're following the order of Simanim, as it's stated in the Arts Girl, which is like a muffin of Moshe Sinai, so it says figs, dates, pomegranates. Now you have a problem. Because the pasuk says in Parshas Ekev, in describing Eretz Yisrael, that Eretz Yisrael is Eretz Chito Usoira, Gepen, Te'ena, Verimain, Eretz Eishem Lutvash. Eretz Yisrael is a land of wheat, of barley, of grapes, Te'ena, Verimain, figs, pomegranates, Eretz Zei Shemen Udvash, a land of Zei Shemen, which is olive oil and date honey. So which, and the Gemara claims that this is the order in which you should make brachas. If you have all these items before you, all the Shivas Haminim, so then you should follow this order. It should be Chita, first Hamaiti, which is what, you know, we do. The only reason we make Kiddush first, that's why we cover the challah when we make Kiddush first, because really, we're jumping the line. We're skipping over the challah. So we cover the challah, we're going to make Kiddush first, because Kiddush is really later on. That's Eretz Chita Usa'era Gefen. Then is Bar Priyagam. So this is the order that should be followed. So if I have apple, apple's not on this list. So guess where apple goes? Last. Orange, last. What comes first? Fig. Figs. Then, at least Rimon, pomegranate seed. But if you're following the order, which you make brachas, which is basic halachas, they teach this in elementary school, the order of brachas, then there used to be people who would do this. This is even before my time in dating. I already feel like a dinosaur. But in, they used to put out, if you wanted to test the, no, you want to test the chassan outright, you know, if he knows, you know, the guy's coming for the date, if he knows halacha, but you put out a platter of Shivas Aminim and see if he knows how to make the brachas, you know, would you like a fig, you know, and see if he knows how to pomegranate maybe, and then see how he does about making the brachas. But, We should be careful about this. This is a real halacha. So, how do we make the bracha on the apple first? So maybe you'll say, let's skip the apple. We'll put the apple to last. We'll make a bar priya eitz on the fig. We'll make a bar priya eitz on the rimon. That's not very traditional. It says in the Kaf HaChayim that the apple is supposed to come first. There's something very special about the apple. Something very special about the apple. What is the apple should really come first? What is so special about the apple? What's so special about the apple? The Kavach Chaim doesn't tell us. Some people think it's because it was the object of the Eitz Hadas. Right? Adam's apple. Why did Adam have an apple? Because the Eitz Hadas was an apple. Who told us the Eitz Hadas was an apple? Chazal told us it was either a wheat stalk, a gefen, right, grapes, or an esrog tree. Not an apple. Who introduced the apple? The King James Bible introduced the apple. So Adam's apple is therefore. If you know Rabbi Nachman's stories, it's interesting. If you know the story of the Lost Princess, I'm not recommending that you read them, but if you happen to know them, probably Michelle just left, so you know, it's still in the air. But if you happen to know the story of the Lost Princess, right, so it's a king who gets angry at his daughter, which represents the Shekhinah, of course, and the Hashras HaShekhinah, and gets angry at her. She runs away, and then the king regrets that he got angry at her, and he goes out, you know, he's worried, where is the Hashras HaShekhinah? So his Mishneh LaMelech, his prince, his second-in-command, chief of staff, goes out to look for the Hashras HaShekhinah, which represents, you know, Kal Yisrael. We're looking for the Hashras Hashkina in this world. And the first thing that this Mishnah Lamelech encounters, as he actually locates the princess, she's trapped in some castle. That sounds like a modern video game, but she's trapped in some castle, and he needs to get her out. In order to get her out, he has to stay outside of the castle for a year. And she tells him, you know, whatever you do, just don't fall asleep. The last day of the year, an apple tree appears. Inevitably, he eats from the apple. This Mishnah Lamelech, the second in command, who's looking for the princess, he eats from the apple and falls asleep. When he wakes up, the princess has moved to level 2. She's no longer there, and she goes on to the next stage. Then he gets to the next stage. He finds her in the palace again. He has to wait outside. This time, there's a vineyard. He drinks, and she tells him, whatever you do, don't drink from the vineyard and fall asleep. The last day of the year, he drinks from the vineyard, falls asleep, and then the princess skips to the next station, the next stop. That's the beginning of the story of the lost princess. So obviously, this is an allusion to the history of mankind. Right? The second stop is Noach, after the Mabul, who drinks from the wine, gets drunk, bad things happen. The first one is obviously an allusion to Adam HaRishon, eating from the Eitz Hadas. The problem is, in the story, the Eitz Hadas is an apple tree, but it's not an apple tree. That was introduced by the King James Bible. It's very disturbing. So Aryeh Kaplan, who has the critical edition of Rabbi Nachman's stories, he opens up the whole story. So yes, it's in the footnotes. This doesn't make any sense. This, we don't believe that the Eitz Hadas was an apple tree. So the truth of the matter is, he doesn't give you the answer, but the truth of the matter is, the apple is a very holy fruit. The apple is a very holy fruit. If you pay attention, if you say these things, the Askini Sugasa, if your family says them, by see the Kabbalistic tefillah before every meal on Shabbos. So we refer to Kadosh Baruch Hu as the Chakal Tapukhin Kadishin. Kadosh Baruch Hu is the holy apple orchard. Holy apple orchard. So the apple is indeed a very holy fruit. In fact, the Pasuk says when Yitzchak wants to give the brachas to Yaakov, and Yaakov dresses up like Esav, so he smells it. Yitzchak thinks it's Esav. In fact, it's Yaakov. He smells Yaakov, and he says, "Hinei reach b'ni kireach hasad asher berach Hashem." You smell like the field that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was blessed. What field is that? It's Gan Eden. And what does he smell like? Rashi quotes him one time. He says, "Smell like apples. Apples. Apples is the smell of Gan Eden." Or the Kal Yisrael is compared to the apple. Why are we compared to an apple? Ketapuach bereach hasad. What he says in Shir Shema. We're compared to apples. Why? Because apples grow, I don't know if this is true, but Mara says, apples, the fruit grows before the leaf. The fruit grows before the leaf. That's like Claudius, we said, Nas of Ishmael, we put the cart before the horse. We said, we'll do the mitzvahs before we heard them. That's like the apple tree. The apple grows before the leaves. Ah, fantastic. The apples are very holy fruit. So that's why the apples to come first. Nothing to do with the Eitz Hadas and Adam's apple and King James Bible. It's because the apple is a holy fruit. There's something special about the apple, by the way. You can't deny that. Right? The apple a day keeps the doctor away. No one ever said. An Esrog a day keeps the doctor away. No one ever said. A raspberry a day keeps the doctor away. There's something special. I don't know what it is about. There's obviously something about apples. So apples should come first. Apples should come first. So what do you do over here? So again, if you're in London, if you're going to approach the Seder of Simon and properly, what you should really do is leave that tray that you bought in pomegranate to some other store. Leave that in the kitchen. First hamoitzi, then the apple. You make the bracha on the apple. Bari priya eitz. There's something special about the apple. You make the bari priya eitz on the apple. Then you bring in all the other simanim. You have your fig, your pomegranate, and all of that. So that's where this comes from. There's a fantastic little gematria. Oh, you have to know this. It's really cute. And the same with chavatav. Chavatav is a classic chassidish sefer. So it says tapuach is gematria 494. 494. The same gematria as Hanashama and Haguf. Hanashama 400, Haguf 94. Hanashama Haguf is the tapuach. Okay, very nice. It represents the binding together of the neshama and the guf, those two warring factions that we have inside each one of us. Neshama and the guf. But here it gets great. He said, what's the difference between neshama and guf? Between 400 and 394. I apologize for the math. Is 304. 304 is gematria dvash. So he says, the dvash, you take the dvash, 304, you put it on haguf, that's 94, and you get haneshama. So what the whole purpose is to elevate the guf with the dvash in order to become on par with the neshama, and all of that is included together in the apple. We hope to elevate the guf as part of the neshama. That's represented by the tapuach dvash. So that's the first thing, and then afterwards follows all the simanim. This all until now, we've been presenting one view of this entire story of simanim, and that is that it's a form of a tefillah. But davening to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, using the Tefillah Simanim as a springboard for tefillah, that's when we had all these technical problems with the Hiratzen and the Brachis and all of these things. The truth of the matter is, if it's a springboard for tefillah, we can understand why you don't even have to see it, eat it. Enough if you just see it. I see the rima and I think, Shiyib is a Kuya Sena Karima. I see the pan and gourd, I say, Shiyikari Gzardinenu. However, there could be another perspective over here, and I think that's what the tour, if you remember, all the way back to the beginning, that's the way the tour saw Simanim. The tour saw Simanim entirely different. The tour never mentions a tefillah. The tour has no tefillahs. The tour says it's not the time for davening. Well, who's davening over the pomegranate? We're davening over a pomegranate and a fig and a carrot. Well, it's not time for davening. There's no davening now. The Gemara never mentioned davening. The Gemara said you eat the Simanim. And the tour, by the way, didn't have any problem at all with the candle that burns to the end as a simon that a person will live throughout the year. It didn't have any problem with the chicken getting fat as a simon that a person will be successful in his business deal. Why not? Isn't that a problem of nichush and superstition? This is not a mahalach. If it's not a tefillah, how do you deal with the whole issue? It seems very superstitious. It seems very superstitious. So I think the answer is, in a question that's raised by the Meir, by the Marsha, which really opens up the whole topic. And that is, the Gemara, I presented it this way, probably didn't notice it, which is my fault, but the Gemara said, what should a person do if he wants to know whether or not he'll live throughout the year? Whether he will or he won't. Light a candle. If it burns to the end, remember that? Or he knows he'll live throughout the year. The Gemara never says, and if it doesn't, fill in the blank. And the Gemara says, what should he do if he wants to know whether he should get in a business deal or not? Will it be successful or not? He should buy a chicken. The chicken gets fat, he knows he'll be successful. The Gemara never says, and if the chicken remains scrawny, one never says the negative side. Why not? So Marsha says one thing, but I would like to say something else. The Marsha says, because superstition is only prohibited if it has a negative side to it. If I see a black cat, it's going to be a bad day, I'm wrapping up, I'm going home. If I walk underneath the ladder, oh boy, who knows what's coming today? That's all negative. I'm implying like Hashem can't override the simanim, the bad signs. That's blasphemy. That's terrible. I can't believe that. That's why superstition is objectionable. But if it's positive, there's a positive side to it, then it's allowed. Superstition is allowed if it's positive. It's okay. So the candle burning to the end, if it burns to the end, you live throughout the year. We don't mention the other side because that would be superstition. The positive side of it is not. Positive side of it is not. It's an interesting distinction. It doesn't really explain why we should distinguish that way, but that's. We could add to it, right? We could understand where he's coming from, because I can't limit the powers of Hashem, but you can add to that, right? So that's. Sounds like that's okay. The problem is, it doesn't really work out in Rosh Hashanah, because we have two other simanim to talk about. One is, it says in the Ramah, not to eat nuts on Rosh Hashanah, because egois is gematria chet. Gematria chet. Shachter loves to point out, chet is also gematria chet. So, better to avoid Averis than avoid the nuts. So people are careful to avoid nuts and not avoid Averis. That's obviously the wrong Hashkafa. But on top of Averis, we should be careful to avoid nuts. Anything that has a nutty flavor to it obviously has nuts in it. If it's so blended in, you can't even tell it's there. It's not a problem. But if it's, but we typically don't do that. Why? Because it sounds like you have a year full of sins. Shouldn't sleep on Rosh Hashanah either. Why not? Sleep on Rosh Hashanah. Right? Sleep a year. Mishnah Berurah calls like that in Yerushalmi. Those are negative. So if the whole justification for all these little superstitions is because it's only positive, it's not negative, these two are negative. So I think we can get around these things, and that is, no, because in Rosh Hashanah we want to eat sweet things. We don't want to eat nuts or not sweet. We're not talking about candied almonds. We want to eat sweet things. On Rosh Hashanah we should be awake because it's the time to be awake. The shofar awakens us. So it's not so much that these are bad signs, but we're depriving ourselves of good signs. Why would you eat nuts when you can eat sweet things? Why would you sleep when you can be awake? So you could rephrase it or reframe it. I think that's what you have to do. But the Marsha never really explains what's the difference. Why, if it's positive, it is allowed, and it's negative, it's not allowed. So Shlomo Kluger has a whole different approach that I think is very meaningful. Shlomo Kluger explains that what the Siman right here to accomplish is not a vehicle for tefillah. It's not what it's about. But Simanim are is a statement of bitachon, and trust in the Ribbono Shel Olam, that I am confident I will have a good year. It's a statement of bitachon. It helps me have bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's why only the positive sides are here. It only mentions, and by the way, it's a gimme, right? You light a candle in a house that has no crosswind. How's the candle going to burn out? You don't have to be a chemist. Who's blowing out the candle? Nothing could possibly happen. Why should the candle? You buy a chicken and you feed it. If it's a normal chicken, it's going to get fat. So it's not a real scientific experiment. The one with the shadows was actually too tricky, so we said, you know what, take that off the agenda. The other ones are just so obvious. It's a layup. I mean, it's gonna, for sure going to happen. And that's exactly the point. The point is, we want to have bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we're going to have a good year. How do we make ourselves feel like we're going to have bitachon? We take a otherwise useless, meaningless item, invest it with significance, and eat it, and now we feel like we're going to have bitachon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It sounds odd. However, to Yisrael, the Reb Chaim Shmulevitz has in the Sichas Moshe. It's a very classical idea. The Gemara says the following in Titus. Listen to this story. The Gemara says, there was once a woman who was trapped in a pit. A man came by. He saved her from the pit in gratitude. This man saving her from the pit, or because I guess they developed a relationship as a result, he proposed marriage. Problem is, there were no witnesses there. Marriage without witnesses, you know, is meaningless. So, what do they do for witnesses? So the man said, I take as one witness the pit itself will be a witness, and there was a weasel nearby, a chulda. He said, the other witness will be the chulda, will be the weasel. They were married. After time, you know, that happened, I guess, one summer. They drifted apart. They went their separate ways. He married someone else. He had two children with that second wife. Both children, Lo Yalenu, died. One was bit by a weasel. The other fell into a pit. So he realized, well, the first marriage, you know, meant something. Forgot about it. How did the first marriage mean anything? It was a weasel and a pit. In the base marriage, that means absolutely nothing. Those are not kosher witnesses. A weasel and a pit. Why should they be meaningful? So Chaim Shmulevitz says, you're right, they're otherwise meaningless items. But since he invested with them with significance, now it has significance. So in his eyes, it has significance. They're witnesses, now it has significance. In the real world, in the physical woman, these actually served as witnesses for Kiddushin. Another example, Chaim Shmulevitz goes to Gemara Chulin. You'll act this Gemara. The Gemara says that a person should never spend more money than he has. Good idea. Live within your means. But if you're spending money on your wife, exceed your means. Always spend more than you have. Why? Because he said it's a good idea that she should think you have more money than you actually have. Why? Because she will have bitachon in you. Wow, my husband is so successful. Even though you're meeting a shlump, he has bitachon that he is so successful that now he will actually become so successful because she believes in him. If you believe in something, you endow it with significance and actually can take on different properties. And so too, it sounds like that's what these simanim are about. These simanim are to give us bitachon that all of us will have, you know, a good year. It's not about the tefillah. It's a statement of bitachon. And maybe that's maybe why you have to eat it. If it's just a vehicle, a springboard for tefillah, I just see it. It inspires me to daven. Okay, maybe you don't have to eat it. You don't have to see it. But if the purpose is a statement of bitachon and ribono shel olam, that I'm going to have a good year, so then maybe it's something that you have to eat. And that's what the simanim are about. And that's why the candle is okay. And that's why the chicken is okay. These are not kishuf. These are not superstition. I'm just giving myself reinforcements. That ultimately HaKadosh Baruch Hu has my back, even though we're scared, of course, in Rosh Hashanah, Sifrei Chaim, Sifrei Meisim, Sukkim Lufanai, at the same time, we have confidence, we have bitachon that the Ribono Shel Olam will save us. Those two emotions really go hand in hand. There's two tekiyos, two sounds we make with the shofar. One is broken, one is solid. The broken sound obviously represents pachad, we're afraid, we're crying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's the trua. The tekiyah is a solid sound. And the tekiyah, right, brackets, the truer, comes on either side. To teach us that, yes, of course we're afraid. Yes, of course it's a scary time. But it's exactly at that time that we're afraid, we turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we have to be tough in the Ribono Shel Olam. You cannot be tough unless you're actually afraid. If you're afraid, then you cannot be tough. So you have to be tough in the Ribono Shel Olam, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has our back. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will seal us for a good year. And that's perhaps what the simanim are about. Eating the simanim, endowing in them significance, makes them significant. Ultimately, though, I think both of these mahalchim, both of these approaches converge to one common theme. Either it's a tefillah, as the Beis Yosef, and Iri told us that, certainly the classical approach, and that's what we all do. Or maybe it's like the tour, it's a statement of bitachon in the Ribono Shel Olam, confidence in Kadosh Baruch Hu, see us when we did. In the end of the day, it boils down to a comment that the Ramban has. Because the truth of the matter is, I can offer a tefillah without a pomegranate seed. We daven every day three times a day without a pomegranate seed. I don't need a date, I don't need a fig. I cannot be tochen without the gourd, the pan, you know, the pumpkin. We cannot be tochen without the fish head. So why do I need these things? I think the answer is found in the Ramban. The Ramban has this idea in a few places that sometimes we need a poel dimyon in order to enable us to imagine this success, in order to enable us to imagine our tefillos being successful, being mekubal, in order to imagine or to instill within us, ingrain within us, the bitachon that we need, our Rosh Hashanah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yes, we're afraid, but we also have bitachon and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because He has our back. We sometimes need a physical manifestation of that which we have in our hearts, what the Ramban calls a poel dimyon. The Ramban has this idea, in a very confusing parasha of the Torah, I'm sure you've read and familiar with, that when Yaakov splits the sheep with Lavan, so Lavan takes the solid sheep, Yaakov takes the striped and the spotted sheep. So what does Yaakov do to have more spots and striped sheep and goats? He puts a stick in front of them as they're mating. That's spotted and striped. When they see the spotted and striped sheep, they produce spotted and striped sheep. So Ramban asks, how does that work? They see the stick that's in front of them, and all of a sudden they're producing these kinds of sheep. So he says yes, because when they imagine the spotted and the striped stick they see in front of them, that's a poel dimyon. That's a physical manifestation of what Yaakovinu has in his heart and in his mind, and that's ultimately therefore what they're able to produce. And sometimes in our life we have so many aspirations, we have so many dreams, we have so many tefillos, we have so much bitachon and kadosh baruch hu, but sometimes it's hard to bring it out, and we need the simanim as a kind of a poel dimyon. Sometimes we have so many tefillos to kadosh baruch hu, and it's hard to trigger them. So the simanim are kind of a poel dimyon to unlock that potential that we have inside of us, and when you're able to see it, it would be that much more successful. There's a book called, it's an old book already at this time now, but called Seven Habits of Highly Successful People. I've heard of it by Stephen Covey. So he gives an example there of this same idea. He doesn't quote the Ramban in the Poel Dimyon, but he talks about the 4-minute mile. The 4-minute mile was a speed barrier. No one was able to run a mile in less than 4 minutes until Roger Bannister in 1954, I think, ran a 4-minute mile. Now, after Roger Bannister did it, every guy in every track team somewhere, can run a 4-minute mile. There's thousands of people run a 4-minute mile. How could it be? One guy did it, now everybody can do it. It was this unbreakable, unachievable feat, and now everyone can do it. So the answer is, athletes are better trained, we have supplements now, we have gyms, maybe, okay, I'm sure is a part of it. But part of it is, and we know this is true, when I see someone else do it, it gives me the confidence to think, that I can do it. So a lot of times, he quotes there, he interviewed Super Bowl winners and World Series winners, and he asked them, how many of you thought you'd actually be here, holding the trophy or whatever they give out at the Super Bowl and the World Series? And, 75% of them said, yeah, this is exactly where I thought I'd be. This is exactly where I thought I'd be. I've been visualizing this moment for years. And it's because of that sometimes that a person is able to be successful. So that's really what the simanim are, to trigger a lot of the stuff we have inside to help us bring it out, to help us bring it to fruition. And Emir Tashem, we should fulfill whatever version of the simanim appeals to you more, whether it's a statement of bitachon HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that He should seal us for a good year, whether it's a tefillah to the Ribbono Shel Olam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should answer all of our tefillahs. Emir Tashem should be Makayim all the bitachon that we have in Him, and seal us and write us for a good and a sweet year, where all of our bakashas are answered. Mm-hmm.